the other line. I clicked over. Dude, I said. What just happened? He said, his voice brimming with excitement and confusion. Not only did I just talk to the president, I think I just got scolded by the president like she was my middle school principal. I don't know why that seems weirder than hanging out with a space alien robot, but it does. What was she pissed about? Oh, you know, just the whole communicating with aliens and providing them with gifts on behalf of my country and my species and my planet instead of letting someone qualified and authorized make that call. That makes a lot of sense now that you say it out loud. Are we going to prison? Huh, no. But I got the feeling that if we do this again, we will have some very powerful enemies. The most powerful, Andy shot back. I suppose that is not an exaggeration, I replied. She said she was about to go on TV to give a speech about the Carls. I assume it's streaming somewhere? I popped open my laptop, and indeed, people were anticipating the speech, which had been announced about an hour earlier. Andy and I stayed on the phone together until the speech began, and then we didn't hang up. We just sat there silently together, listening to the other person listening to the speech. Her points were well constructed. First, she wanted to be clear that there was no danger. All health concerns had been eliminated, and the Carls appeared to be completely non-threatening. The dream seemed to be a harmless call for people across this planet to work together. Carl's hand was still missing, and the magic castle was cooperating. She then discussed a little bit of how they had eliminated other possibilities, ending with the kicker that the Carls weren't in fact standing on the sidewalk. They were hovering micrometers above it, completely immobile and unable to be moved by any amount of force applied to them. They had jackhammered under the one in Oakland. It remained there, hanging above the space where the sidewalk had been. She pitched it as a wonderful moment to be alive, assuring us that the government was hard at work uncovering the mysteries of the Carls, and all of humanity would have to work together to solve the mysteries of the dream. It was good. It was sudden for almost everyone, but not for me. It was this slow, gradual feeling, like your dog dying a year after being diagnosed with cancer. I had a little bit come to terms with it, but still, then your dog dies, and your dog will never not be dead. It happened. It was official. The President of the United States had confirmed it. The scientists had been consulted. The Carls were aliens. And we were not alone in the universe. God damn, Andy said afterward. God damn, I confirmed. Chapter 11. Okay, there's a lot to tell here. First, let's go back in time about 6 months. I was walking out of the bathroom and Maya was on my bed with her drawing tablet hooked up to her laptop. I peeked over her shoulder and said, "What are you working on? It looks adorable." As she slammed her laptop shut. "Whoa, huh. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to peek." "No, it's fine. I don't know. It's..." This had never happened. Maya had always felt like an open book to me. "Do you have a secret?" I said, genuinely amused. She looked at me, at first annoyed, and then I could see her getting excited. "April." A smile started eating away at her face. "I do." And then suddenly, 6 months into our relationship, I discovered that my girlfriend had an entire alternate life. As previously mentioned, Maya is an amazing illustrator. She does fantastic hand lettering, but she's also great at character design, and her specialty is cats. Maya can draw 30 individual, adorable cats in like 15 minutes. The first time I saw one, I had no idea that the character design of the little fluff balls had been an ongoing process since she was in middle school. The final product was both elegant and adorable. It was unclear where their heads ended and their bodies began, and each managed to look distinct while clearly using the same visual language. Sometime during college, before I knew her well, she meshed two of her hobbies, drawing adorable cats and criticizing late capitalist financialization, into The Proletariat, a webcomic about anti-capitalist cats. It had gained a substantial following, and remarkably, through a combination of crowdfunding and t-shirt sales, it was generating enough revenue that she couldn't just stop doing it. But she also, for both professional and personal reasons, liked having The Proletariat be a secret project. Creating content and not taking credit for it, or leveraging it to promote your other socials is so anti-now, but it was how I used to be, and it was a quality I really loved and love about Maya. Anyway, that's why I freaked out a bit when I heard the screen name The Proletarian. It probably wasn't Maya, but also maybe it was. After Andy and I finished debriefing post-speech, I took out my phone to think about texting Maya. Of course I didn't. I had tweet storms to outline and Facebook posts to write. Andy was working on a script, but I was sure I'd want to make a bunch of changes. Robin was texting me for yes-nos on interview requests, and while I managed all that, another call from my parents came in. Hey, guys. I knew from experience it would be both of them. Hi, April. My mom sounded worried on the speakerphone. Based on when you're posting on Facebook, we are assuming that you never sleep. How are you holding up? This was not something I had checked. Fine, I guess. I just talked to the president. What? They both said, and then my dad added, Honey, that's amazing. After her speech? Before, actually. I was talking to her when you called me the first time. Well, usually we're frustrated when you don't pick up, but this was a good reason, my mom said, right on the edge of a guilt trip. What did you talk about? We talked about the dream and about how maybe I should have acted a little less carelessly, and she, I think, basically gave me her phone number. Wow, my dad said. April, honey, do you think that maybe she was right about you? I didn't let her finish. Yes, Mom, I do. I really do. I was feeling properly chastised. I had crossed a line, and I was finally starting to understand that. I'm sorry, it was a dumb risk. I wasn't thinking. We all got ourselves worked up and excited by the mystery of it all. I'm sorry if I freaked you guys out. We're just glad you're safe, April, my dad said. Yeah, I know, Dad. You guys are great. It's just all really exciting. I mean, the president! This is pretty weird. April? My mom's tone did not reflect my excitement. Do you think maybe there are good reasons to be worried about this dream? That slowed me down. I mean, I am not a neuroscientist or whatever, but I was aware that a dream shouldn't be able to be passed from person to person. And people on the news were already talking about how the Carls had clearly altered the brains of humans, which was not a simple intrusion. It was significant. It was scary. Have you guys had it yet? I said. No, not yet. There was a little apprehension in my dad's voice. It's not scary. If anything, it's fun. I think Carl is trying to give humanity a project to work on together. Maybe they're testing us to see if we can cooperate. How long until it's everyone? I don't know, Mom, but it's not something you should be scared of. But they're changing our brains. They changed your brain already, right? Like, this dream doesn't act like normal dreams. What if it changed you more than you think it did? That was indeed a scary thought, and hearing it from my mom rather than some internet troll made it seem a lot more real and a lot more worrying. I don't know, Mom. I know that if the Carls wanted to hurt us, they probably would have just hurt us. I honestly don't know more than you, but I didn't want to say the thing I was about to say, but I had started, so I said it anyway. I guess I just have faith. April, my dad said, I know you have an awful lot of work to do, and I know that you never stop when something isn't done. That's something I've always respected about you. But take some breaks, honey. Call us. Spend time with Maya. Just take a walk sometimes. Oh, Dad, Mom, Maya and I, we broke up. And here it was all again, confronting the reality of my idiocy and uselessness. Just in that moment when my dad was being very kind, I had to remind him how screwed up I was. Oh, honey, my mom now, we're so sorry. You don't have to talk about it now. They knew me well enough that they wouldn't push for the story. They knew what had happened. Not the details, but that I'd cut a string if I ever felt it holding me back. They didn't like it, but they weren't going to fix it. Eventually, my dad said, Tom's wedding is coming up. We'll have a nice long chat about all of this there. We'll make some time. It doesn't have to be all about him. We love you, April. And then my mom added, call us. After that, I lowered myself into the news storm. The president hadn't mentioned me by name in her speech, but there was reference to my work. I was now inextricably linked to this story. Not because I discovered Carl, and not because I was the first person with a following to come out and say he was an alien, and not because I seemed to be the reason his hand fell off and ran across Hollywood, but because I was all three of those things. Robin sent a car for me and I went to a satellite studio. From there, video of me sitting in front of the Manhattan skyline could be beamed to any show anywhere. A producer guy told me whom I'd be talking to and where, and a little earpiece was my only connection to those people. It was a step up in quality from Skyping in, and a step down from being there in the studio. This way, though, I could be on every news program that mattered on both coasts without leaving the room. As this was the biggest story of all time, absolutely everyone was available to talk, and I got put on panels with them all, whether we had anything to do with one another or not. I talked to retired generals, physicists, sleep psychologists, neurologists, actors who had played aliens in movies, famous science communicators. Everyone wanted a piece of the story. And the news shows were building panels out of the biggest names trying to one-up each other. So yes, I talked to a lot of fancy and famous people that day, and I felt surprisingly comfortable doing it. There was only one interview that was decidedly unpleasant. News anchor lady. Joining us today to talk about this remarkable news, April May, discoverer of New York Carl. I waved. And Peter Petrowicki, author of Amazon number one ranked Invaded. He nodded. Peter, let's start with you. The news about Carl has been out for only a few hours, but you already have a book climbing the charts on Amazon. How did that happen? Petrowicki was beamed in from somewhere else via satellite, so he appeared in the little on-screen box next to mine. He looked exactly like every guy I had ever seen walking down Wall Street at lunch. Mid-40s, dark hair, tan, white teeth, gray suit, light blue shirt, open a couple of buttons, no tie. If he was going for any particular look, it was exactly average. Of course, I couldn't see him then. The entire show was just voices in my ear. Well, just like April here, I felt it was becoming more and more clear that something odd was going on, and the number of explanations that made sense was getting pretty thin. Obviously, I don't talk about the president's statement in my book, though I'm already working on an updated version, but this seemed like the story of the century, and I felt like I had an obligation to bring some truth to the table. And April, what do you think of Mr. Petrowicki's assertion that the Carls are potentially a threatening and invading force? You can see on the tape that this completely blindsided me. The correct response, now that I know my way around every potential interview environment, would have been to say, I don't know anything about what Mr. Petrowicki is working on, but... And then I would just say what I wanted to say. Instead, I reacted defensively. I think it's foolish. And then I paused to gather my thoughts a bit, but before I could continue. It's foolish? Is it foolish to consider the security of Americans when a far more powerful force suddenly appears in our cities? A force that has now gone underground and is roaming around who knows where? A force that has not just invaded our cities, but now our minds? You think a little caution is foolish? If I was supposed to respond, I was not able to. Thankfully, the anchor took over for me. But Mr. Petrowicki, what do we know about the actual intentions of the Carls? We know they are wearing armor. We know they came unannounced. We know they violated international and domestic law. We know they have asked for radioactive materials, one of which was provided for them by our guest here. I froze up. I wouldn't have been more still if he had been holding a gun to my head. I shot a quick, "What the fuck is this guy?" glance at Robin, but he gestured to me to keep my eyes on the camera. Looking away makes you look weird. Again, the anchor chimed in. Yes, April. That does seem like it was quite an extraordinary step for a private citizen to take. Thankfully, I was prepared for this question. Americium, the element we provided, is a common household product. We purchased it at the CVS just down the street from Hollywood Carl. It's radioactive, but so is the sun. I agree, we got too caught up in the fun, though. We should have presented our findings to the government to let them decide what to do with the information. This was the talking point we'd decided to go with. If you were watching the interview, which I watched several times in later days, you would have seen Petrowicki with a look on his face like, yeah, duh, you also should not have been an idiot, snotty, shitty little know-it-all brat. The anchor took over again. The president seems to think the Carls pose no threat. I was waiting for the anchor to finish her question, but Peter just picked it right up. I don't mean to alarm anyone, but you and I know exactly as much about this as the president does. It serves her purposes for us to believe these things peaceful envoys. But why, in the face of this immense threat, would we assume the best? Wouldn't it make more sense to exercise even a little caution? It seems to me, I said, that if the Carls wanted to hurt us, they're powerful enough that they could just wipe us off the planet. So you would suggest what, that we just lie down in the face of their great power and let them do what they will? No. I mean, there is nothing threatening about what they've done. They're sculptures. They've visited every place equally, and they're providing games to play in our dreams. Again, you have no idea. No one has any idea what their intent is, where they're from, what they want with us. But I can tell you that in the history of our planet, advanced civilizations meeting less advanced cultures doesn't usually end well for the less advanced people. No, that's not a tendency. It's a rule, a law. The president and every citizen in this country has an obligation to consider this threat. And what would that look like? The anchor said. This is America. We have never been scared away from a fight. When we are pressured, that is when we are greatest. That is when we accomplish the most. That's all the time we have. After the break, and that was it. Next interview, KCKC radio interview in 10 minutes, the producer said. Who the fuck was that guy? I said, tearing my earpiece out. To save you the scrambling Robin and I did to figure that out before the radio interview I had in 10 minutes, here's what we discovered. Just like me, Peter Petrowicki was in demand. His book, Invaded, was more like a blog post with cover art. It was 20 pages long, and he'd update it whenever there was new news. It was only available online, but it was the top-selling book on Amazon. It was $3. It was also the only book about Carl in the whole world, so that helped. He'd had guest columns in a few papers, mostly conservative-leaning. He'd been doing the news circuit since his book came out, which was the day after the Hollywood Carl video. A few politicians had started to use his talking points, that the president was soft, that the Carls were a threat, that if giant robots could suddenly appear in every city in America, somehow the rest of the world was left out, what was to stop giant nuclear warheads from appearing and exploding? Hide your kids, hide your wives, there's a space alien terrorist on 23rd. Before Carl, Peter Petrowicki was a low-level conservative hawk journalist, which I put in quotation marks because he seems to have never done a moment of research in his life. He was one of thousands of people who scraped by filtering reality through their ideology and then yelling really loudly at the internet. But his quick thinking and writing, it took him 2 days to write the first draft of his manifesto, had made him an instant voice. This might have stung all the more because I had a fairly similar trajectory. I inserted myself into this conversation when I didn't really belong there. I was pitching a particular ideology that fit for some people but didn't fit for others. It made perfect sense that a different perspective was going to feel more legitimate to people who were more afraid of otherness. A competing ideology was bound to pop up. I just didn't realize that at the time. And so I was legitimately shocked that people were paying attention to Peter Petrowicki. His perspective was ludicrous for a number of pretty obvious reasons. First, if the Carls wanted to destroy us as we had both agreed, they could do it instantaneously. Just because someone has power over you doesn't mean they're going to use it to hurt you. People who believe that tend to either be, one, people who have been victims of that sort of behavior, or, two, people who, if given power, will use it to hurt you. Peter struck me as the latter. In the space of 10 minutes of research, my vague understanding of that asshole morphed into a fully fleshed-out mental map of the hairball of hate that was Peter Petrowicki. He was scaring people unnecessarily for his own personal gain. And from that fear was rising a fledgling hatred of Carl that lit a fire in me. And he'd been on the news every single day since Hollywood Carl's hand popped off, while I'd been breaking up with my girlfriend, moving apartments, answering emails, and replying to YouTube comments. This guy had built an anti-Carl ideology and inspired a growing army of followers. I had even seen them in my comments, but I just ignored them like they were normal haters. But there's a big difference between an isolated troll and a movement. This was a movement. And I had completely misidentified or willfully ignored it. In the days after Maya and I had broken up, I realized I was just reacting to what was happening. I was trying to keep the jolt of constant attention alive, and who could blame me? There was a lot happening, and I was overwhelmed. But I was also running out of fuel, and I could feel it. I had solved my mystery, and the new one was far too big for any one person to tackle on their own. I thought maybe I was done, that maybe I could coast forever on what we'd done in 2 weeks. I was running out of that good ambition fuel, and maybe we had done all we could do. Talking to the president was temporary fuel. The importance of the Hollywood Carl video was as well. Even knowing that I would go down in history as the person who made first contact with an alien, that was somehow fleeting. Those things felt good, but they couldn't keep feeling as good as they had felt when they first happened. And as they receded, even in the moments immediately after they happened, I felt the hole they left behind growing inside of me. But this was different. My annoyance became frustration, which became anger, which became hate. And hate is a long-burning fuel. Peter Petrowicki refilled my tank. This was excellent for my short-term mental health and productivity, but terrible for absolutely everything else. Peter Petrowicki also gave me a bunch of strategies. I took his playbook and turned it right around on him, except I had a bigger audience and a better message. As soon as I was home from the satellite studio, I had Andy come over to make a video pulling Peter Petrowicki apart at the seams. I read and watched everything of his that I could get my hands on. I even shelled out the $3 for his book. Then I took his arguments one by one and shoved them right back down his throat to rejoin the fetid lump that spawned them. Another thing I learned from him was to take what his supporters were saying as if it was what he was saying. He was fanning flames that ought not be fanned, and highlighting the worst of his audience was an easy way to show it. And of course, I had no idea of this then, but by engaging with him, I was affirming him and his wackos. Their ideas were getting more exposure through my larger audience, and I, and of course every news channel out there, was confirming the idea that there were two sides you could be on. It was a huge mistake, and also great for views. It was a pretty dramatic shift for my channels. We had been informative, sure, but mostly wholesome, endearing, witty, and pretty lovey-dovey with the whole thing. The brand was happy, excited, interested. Now suddenly we were adding snark and bite and, yeah, politics. We went from being a thing that everyone knew about to a thing that everyone could have an opinion on. If Peter had opinions about why the Carls were here, then I had to have opinions as well. I started being more overt with my suspicions that they were watchers, sent to observe how humanity reacts to the knowledge that they are not alone. This fit in well with the dream. They were giving us a task that none of us could accomplish on our own. If we could accomplish it, that would show that we were a global cooperative species. The consequences for failing the test that Carl had put to us could be dire, or they could be nothing at all. The consequences for passing, though, might be the end of poverty and disease. Whoever made the Carls obviously had technology far superior to ours. And if they wanted to, they might offer us everything from interstellar travel to immortality. Of course, I was pulling this all straight out of my ass. I didn't know if the Carls were dangerous or if my mind was being controlled. Who cared, as long as my made-up shit wasn't as poisonous as Peter Petrowicki's made-up shit? In the end, my brand was me. So whatever I said became something I believed. Chapter 12. And that's how I came to spend months of my life being exactly the thing I hated most in the world. A professional arguer. A pundit. Not because I was good at it or because I needed the money, but because I was mad and scared and I didn't know what else to do. The Carls had become more than my life. They were my identity. I used to be good at TV because I didn't care, and that irreverence was something people enjoyed. Now I had to be good because I did care. And that's what I try to take away from this period. Whatever I did it because I cared. I believed Carl was a force for good in the world, and humanity's opinion of Carl mattered because I came to honestly believe that the Carls were here to judge us. It didn't even matter if I was right, because that was the world I wanted to live in. That was the world that made sense to me. And even if I was wrong, I believed the world would be better off if we just acted as if I was right. Every person who joined the loosely defined international and mostly online movement that Peter was part of, which of course became known as the Defenders, was a vote against humanity. We just went through about 3 weeks of my life and it took almost half of this book. Now things are going to get a lot more spaced out. I hope you don't mind. I am not proud of these months. But more important, they were mostly boring. And you know that we're still a ways away from July 13th, and you're wondering when the heck we're going to get there. So I think I can give you a pretty good idea of what went down during those months with some vignettes. And I'm going to start each one with a tweet I posted that day. Like this. February 12th. At April May Be Not. Polly Shore is the hero we deserve. I'm sitting in the studio/office that Andy and I built in my apartment's second bedroom. It's a complete mess except for the area behind my desk that Andy and I have made look respectable so that I can make videos easily. There's a semi-impressionist portrait of Carl on the wall behind me that we commissioned from a friend at SVA. One of the best things about having money is paying people to do good work. Another good thing about money is that it makes problems go away. For example, Robin has brought us not only pizza, but also a second phone for me, dedicated entirely to April May, the internet persona. We can pass it around so that Miranda or Andy or Robin can all tweet as me, while I can keep my personal phone dedicated to actually being a normal human. The camera and lights are all facing me, but they're off. Robin is sitting in the swivel chair Andy usually sits in while we make videos. We're both eating the pizza he's just brought up from Frank's downstairs. I've been trying to write the thing that would become My Life with Carl for about a week. So far, it's terrible, but I need to get something out. Putnam said we were losing a lot more than money. She feared we were losing a stake in the world. Every time someone says best-selling author Peter Petrowicki without being able to say best-selling author April May is a day that we lose credibility, were, I think, her exact words. Robin, is ghostwriting really okay? I asked with a mouthful of pizza. I had gotten extremely comfortable with Robin. Andy was in the living room, which we had set up as his in-apartment office, probably editing an episode of Slain Spotting. Yes, even after all this, he was still making his dumb podcast with his teammate Jason. It's standard industry practice, he said, looking a little uncomfortable. Look, Robin, I said, turning to him. I like you. I think you're smart. I need you to be helpful and useful to me, and that is going to require you to be honest. I appreciate you not outright lying like Putnam does, but I need you to be totally straight with me whenever possible. He looked even more uncomfortable. Jennifer has not been lying to you. Oh, really? What about when she told me that no one thinks ghostwriting is skeezy anymore? I didn't even know what ghostwriting was, but when she explained it to me, I thought it was skeezy, so obviously someone does. She's trying to make you feel better about the easiest and best path forward. Do you think having someone else write a book and then putting my name on it is the best path forward? Traffic was still closed on 23rd, so it was eerily quiet. It is certainly a path, but to me it does not seem like the kind of thing April May would do. Oh God, even my friends think of me as two different people. He blushed a bit there, which I didn't get at the time. It's how you talk about yourself. It's hard not to pick up the habit. He smiled. I was still April May, the snarky BFA grad, but that's not who I wanted the world to see. That wasn't the person who would establish first contact with an alien race. So I was also April May, the surprising, quirky, unassuming, but passionately intelligent speaker for the Carls. So you don't think I should have it ghostwritten? It does not seem like the sort of thing April May would do, he repeated. Ugh! I completely agree with you, and it is so annoying. How long are books? How much do the NaNoWriMo people write? I'll look it up. He started to get out his laptop. 50,000! Andy shouted from the living room without missing a beat. I turned back to Robin with a smirk. Always use all the tools at your disposal. So that means I only need to write one word 50,000 times. I mean, not the same word over and over. How many words are on the average tweet? Like 20? So that's just like 2,500 tweets. I can tweet 2,500 times. Oh God, I probably have. Can we just publish a book of my tweets? No, but there are degrees of doing this on your own. You don't have to sit in here by yourself for a month straight doing nothing but writing. I think what we need to do is get you a great editor. Someone who has worked on books like these. If they end up writing a significant part of the book, you can credit them as a co-author because that's the sort of thing April May would do. He smiled at me. Robin had a narrow frame and bright, bright blue eyes. He didn't smile much, so when it happened, it felt good. I leaned toward him a bit. I'm glad you think so highly of me. He leaned away, pulling his laptop onto his lap. I'll email Jennifer about getting you some meetings with editors. You'll have your pick, I think. I watched his hands move over his keyboard and thought to myself, we should put him in videos more. February 19th. At April May Be Not. What do you think is the best profession for your spouse to have? At April May Be Not. Everyone is saying masseuse or doctor, but I think it's political pundit because that way you can shake them awake tomorrow morning and tell them that you're going to divorce them if they don't quit their terrible job that is destroying America. At April May Be Not. And yes, I am aware that I am a political pundit. I'm sitting in a prêt-à-manger in Midtown. Because of the constant stress of being April May, I have forgotten what sleeping a full night is like, and I am now a huge fan of coffee. I usually get an Americano with two shots, no room for cream, but I dump sugar in it because it makes it taste like hot chocolate. At the table with me are Robin and Sylvia Stone, who is the second editor we've met with. The first guy was sure he knew exactly what I wanted to do with my book and got frustrated when I disagreed with him. I hated the meeting so much I pretended like I had diarrhea to get out of it. Sylvia, in her mid-30s, dressed in a black silk button-down and jeans, with dark glasses around her gray eyes, was fitting my image of whom I wanted to work with a lot better. You've got two big problems with this story, Sylvia was saying. First, it's too big. The whole world is in it, and people will be looking to you for a full story. You can't just crank out some piece of slop because the whole world will want to read it. There's an obligation, and that can be a lot of weight. Robin looked at me. I nodded, knowing that this was at least part of the problem I had been having. Second, it's not over. You're in the middle right now. If the dream had never happened, there would be a clear narrative arc of this thing. It would end in some mystery, but in an appropriate amount of resolved mystery. Instead, there are millions of people working hard every day trying to solve the puzzles in the dream, and more of them are indeed getting solved every day. We can't even endeavor to tell the whole story because we're in the middle of it. Okay, I think you've put your fingers on at least two of the many problems I have, I said to her. That doesn't necessarily help me, though. You have to define a timeline, and you have to decide what you want to get across. What are your goals with the book? What do you want everyone to think when they finish it? Do you want them to understand you? Do you want them to understand your story? Honestly, I just want them to come away feeling like this is an opportunity for humanity, and that the Carls are a good thing, not some alien nightmare. Oh, that's really good, actually. Say that again, but more. Huh? Oh, sorry, She looked a little flustered. I was editing you. I'm sorry, it's a habit. I just mean, tell me more about that idea. I laughed. That's pretty great, actually. That was a good note. I'm honestly worried. Because I think we're just starting to get used to the impact that the social internet is having on us culturally and emotionally and socially. It wasn't exactly bringing us together before this, right? But now I'm worried we have this whole other massive change to get used to. If we keep driving wedges, if we keep getting more and more scared. I trailed off because I didn't actually know what that would mean. I just knew it would be bad. It's like when winter comes and it sucks outside and the sun starts going down at 4:30 and you can look at that and get pissed and sad and grumpy. Or you can invite some friends over and make hot chocolate and share blankets and light candles and tell dumb high school stories. Both of those are natural ways to respond to it getting fucking gross outside. Both fit really well with winter, but one is great and one sucks. It's like that, except with space aliens instead of winter. Did I take your note well? I asked, finally taking a breath. April, I want to help you write this book. And the good news is that a manifesto is probably the easiest book for you to write. You can put in moments of your story, but more than anything, you're making an argument. That's a very traditional format for a book, and one that does not have to be long. You talk to experts, who will all take your calls, you quote them, you build an argument, and you publish the book. I could write the outline for that book this afternoon. Probably faster if you helped me. Robin had said this lady was no nonsense. She had bylines in every major newspaper and magazine in the world and had several books as well. The most popular of which I had downloaded on Audible and listened to a bit of, called Luck Be a Liar. It was about how people are fooled by imagined or insignificant patterns into believing things that are very wrong. I liked it. Okay, let's do it, I said. Okay, Sylvia replied. You'll place a mine. Why not right here? Let's build an outline, I said, not really knowing what that meant. Robin said nothing. I think he was terrified of showing me how pleased he was because he thought maybe I'd notice and change my mind just to spite him. In an hour's time, we had built a book. It wasn't written, but it was constructed. It had an introduction in which I talked a bit about me, but other than that, the chapters were basically arguments against being afraid of the Carls, and that was that. Easy. I took the outline home that night and I fleshed out some of the sections. Sylvia sent them back to me with some comments and ideas for whom we could talk to get quotes and more robust backing for my ideas. March 10th. At the Caddy 95. April May is pretty cute, but she completely ruins it by being so full of herself. At April May be not. I mean, definitionally though, what else am I supposed to be full of? It's just me in here. Well, me and an embarrassing number of Doritos. I've been so stressed that I injured myself. I'm 23 years old and my back has flipped out. Maybe from sleeping weird. Maybe from staying up late working on the final revisions of the book. Maybe from stress. Let's be honest, it's from stress. I've been interviewed for TV, radio, magazines, and newspapers for 2 months straight. First I was telling my own story, then I was defending Carl. But before long I was defending the president, the Constitution, and freedom of speech. Robin had hired tutors specializing in press relations, government, and international law to try to make it sound like I knew WTF I was talking about. The scary part was that I had started to actually know WTF I was talking about, and I passionately believed it. Robin also booked me this appointment at a day spa. Just some alone time to get my whole body rubbed by a stranger, get my toes fancied up, and maybe come out of it feeling a bit more like a human. The people at the place were all deferential and nice. They knew who I was, and they would have been happy to talk, but they also knew when a client didn't want to, and honestly, I didn't want to. This is going to sound weird, but, like, it was nice to just have someone touch me. Flirting with Robin was like flirting with a statue. He kept it so professional that we didn't even hug. Sometimes I lie in my bed at night and fantasize about someone lying on top of me. I just wanted to feel another human. I'd been so cooped up working on the book, staring at it, talking to Sylvia about it. It was like my body had stopped existing. Anyway, I came out of the massage feeling slightly refreshed. The silent time was a good opportunity to put myself in check and make sure that I was working on all the things I wanted to be working on, that the not sleeping and stress were worth it. I thanked the ladies in the lobby, and as I left, they looked a little nervous, which I just put down to them not quite knowing how to behave around April May. It became apparent that it was more than this when a woman came out of the back having finished her spa day as well. She was in her 50s. She looked as pampered and primped as could be, and she was using that voice that some rich people in New York use that says, "I'm only talking to one person, but I would nonetheless like everyone in the world to hear me." And her nerve! She gets on with Rachel Carver and thinks she can go toe-to-toe on international relations? She's a child. It would be funny if it weren't so disgusting. She was accompanied by the massage therapist who had been working on her. "Ah, that's funny," I thought. "I was on the Rachel Carver show like 3 days ago." Everyone in the room knew what was going on way before I did. Everyone wanted to stop it. No one could. Her therapist tried to change the subject rapidly, glancing in my direction. "I really hope your IT band is feeling better, ma'am. It really seemed to loosen during the session." "Yes, well, it's probably all of this drama. I just hate that that thing is in my city and there's nothing I can do about it. And people like that child." And that's when she saw me. She immediately went silent, which was the moment I finally realized that she'd been talking about me. "Well, let's just get you checked out so you can be on your way," the therapist said to her. Robin had already paid for me, so I just turned around to leave the lobby, heading into the hallway and then the elevator, which blessedly arrived before the woman came out of the spa studio. This dumb little moment was the first time I heard a stranger hating me in public. I knew then, for real, that thousands of people were having that exact conversation all over the world every moment of every day. Those people were real, and their thoughts were formed by overblown or just straight made-up stories about me that I could never adequately defend myself against. People all over the world whom I had never met and would never meet hated me. Hated. And what they thought about me was completely out of my control. At this point in my life, I was tweeting about pretty much everything of note that happened to me. You can never stop creating content, both because it feels nice to have people listen, and because you have to keep people's attention. And I had become accustomed to measuring my life in likes. I did not tweet about this encounter. I didn't even tell anyone about it. I just texted Robin to tell him how wonderful my spa day was and how great he was for thinking of me. I knew that if I stopped being mad at that lady and at all her compatriots all over the world, I would have to experience some feelings that were much worse than rage. So instead of talking to any of the people who could have helped me at that moment, I went home and read blog posts about how I was awful, ugly, and a traitor. March 17th. At Prime Patriot. Sometimes I wonder how much people like April May are being paid to shill for the government. At April, maybe not. They pay me in Pop-Tarts. So many Pop-Tarts. Why did I sign this deal? I have a problematic number of Pop-Tarts. I'm leaning out over my balcony, watching, with Andy standing next to me. He's filming as they remove the tent from over Carl and reopen 23rd Street. Thank the Lord the noise will be back. Also, now I can truly look down on Carl and see him there beside the phone booths that, for some reason, are still taking up valuable street real estate in Manhattan. My book is in the hands of a legion of copy editors trying to find every mistake and mislaid argument. There's nothing I can do to help it at the moment, which is wonderful, because I'm fucking sick of the book. Also, we've got videos to make. The army of experts who had been flowing into the tent they had erected around Carl had figured out more or less absolutely nothing in the past few weeks. Did they deliver uranium to Carl to see what happened? I don't know, but I'm pretty sure someone somewhere did, though it didn't seem that there was any immediate effect. If they did discover something new about Carl, they didn't tell anyone. What we knew was that he wasn't standing on the sidewalk, he was hovering very slightly above it, latched onto space somehow. He was not at all thermally conductive. It seemed that the atoms of our world didn't even interact with the atoms of his body. He couldn't be moved or damaged. It was as if we could see him, but he was not actually in our space. Except for Hollywood Carl's hand, of course, which still hadn't been seen since it disappeared into that weird magician's club. Suddenly, Peter Petrowicki was there, down on the street, followed closely by a young guy holding a camera. Some police started harassing him. I couldn't hear what was happening. He looked indignant. He was gesturing to Carl and to the building behind him. The police looked like they really, really didn't want to be in the video, but they also had instructions to not let anyone near Carl right now. Besides, the street hadn't been opened yet, so how did he even get in? How can anyone look at that guy and not immediately get that he is the worst thing that ever existed? Andy said. There are people who say the same thing about me, I mused. Peter posted the video later, and of course Andy and I watched it. It's mostly Peter saying, What have you found out? Is it safe? You clearly thought there was enough danger to block off the street last month. What have you found out that makes it safe now? The people deserve to know. That kind of thing. But then he cuts from the street to him sitting in a small but chic office. Eventually a time comes when we must take some action. I am calling on the defenders to begin collecting data from the dream privately. I know that many of us would rather not interface with the dream at all, that we wake ourselves up immediately to prevent it from further infecting our minds, but while hundreds of passcodes have been uncovered already, hundreds remain. And if someone reckless is the first to decipher what the code means, that could put the entire planet at risk. We must decipher the code first. We can and must work together to play this game so that we can control the outcome, and I am linking to several spaces online that we have created for that purpose. We have information that several governments are already putting personnel to work to attempt to solve the code before anyone else. But I don't believe governments should be trusted with this either. While we can work together when a code is deciphered, we must put that information in a central and secret location. I have created an encryption code, and am including below instructions for how to use it. If you find a code, please send it to us, encrypted, and we will check it in the dream for accuracy, and add it to our proprietary list of codes only defenders will have access to. With the size, passion, and intelligence of this community, I believe we will be the first to understand what the next chapter in the story is. And I know we are the only ones I would trust with that information. Thank you, and stay safe. "Thank you and stay safe" was how he ended all his videos. Pretentious and subtly menacing. Peter Petrowicki all the way. "We're going to have to do that now too," I said after we'd finished watching the video. "Fuck that, we're above his shit." Andy was pretty pissed. "This is something the Carls want humanity to do together. Pitting us against each other, that's what Peter wants." "No, he just made it impossible for people to feel like we're investigating some great caper as a species. I want that as much as you do, but I can't encourage people to post discovered codes publicly. If he has access to all the secret ones they have, plus all the public ones everyone else has, the defenders really will decipher the code first, and be in control at that point. Maybe that's a race that it's okay to lose." "Fuck that," I parroted back to him. "I'm not letting him win." "Let's take some time to think, at least. Assemble the brain trust." So we did. We got Miranda and Robin on Skype and explained Petrowicki's plan. "That is not good," Miranda said. "This is a genius move on PP's part. Not only does it give them a chance at winning, just framing it as a competition instead of a collaborative effort helps their cause. It slows everyone down and it pits us all against each other." "Yeah, I get it. Dude's a genius and he sucks. So what do we do?" I asked. No one said anything for a moment. "Well, I have no idea," Robin said, which must have been physically painful for him. Not being able to help was his least favorite feeling in the world. "To be honest with you, I don't even know very much about the dream." "Me either," I replied. Everyone looked surprised.
"Really?"
Robin said.
"Yeah,"
Andy added. "I would have assumed you'd be all over it. Mysteries are your thing. You are a freaking pet detective."
"What?"
Miranda and Robin said simultaneously.
"I'll tell you guys about it later. It's weird when there are billions of other people on the case. I just feel like my efforts are better spent elsewhere. The chances of me uncovering a unique passcode are like nil, so Miranda, I guess you're the only one of us who spends much time in the dream."
No, it stresses me out. Once I start on a puzzle, I can't stop, and then I stop having normal dreams. You still wake up rested, which doesn't make any sense and is probably impossible, but I don't like waking up frustrated. I just wake myself up and then go back to bed and sleep like a normal person for the rest of the night. I felt like my time is better spent working on the output. The passcodes are spitting out hex code, which people have figured out can be compiled sensically into a vector image. That's like an image that is made up of math.
Yeah, Andy and I are very aware what vector images are.
Oh, right, designers, Miranda said. Well, anyway, the problem is that every time a new string of code gets added, the image changes shape completely. It's basically a big mess of interrelating math, so whenever anything is added, everything changes. No piece of code is at all useful without all of them.
Do they know how many there are?
I asked, genuinely surprised that I didn't know any of this yet.
Probably, Miranda said. There's no way to know if it's actually following the image format perfectly, but if it is, then there are 4,096 total fragments of code. But again, I don't know anything about the dream itself, only about what it's been spitting out.
Okay, so none of us spend time in the dream. Do we trust anyone who does?
Andy asked.
There was an active Wikipedia page of completed puzzles. So far, more than 500 had been solved. I kept tabs on it both because I wanted to see how it was going and because the list contained the names or screen names of people who had assisted on solving puzzles. If you sorted by that number, the top 10 names or so had become fairly well known among people who even peripherally followed the dream. At number 3, with sole or shared credit on 11 confirmed passcodes, was the Perletarian.
Well, I said. Never mind.
Okay, that's not how sentences work, Andy said. Once you say, well, you've committed yourself to finishing the thought.
I think Maya may be the Perletarian.
What?
Andy almost shouted. Robin and Miranda were quiet.
They knew of Maya, but they'd never met her.
And why do you think this is?
Andy asked. It's a secret? Robin broke in here from inside the computer.
Do you want to contact her to ask what she thinks about the situation?
Is she online? I asked.
Yeah. Should I go chat with her?
Andy was hesitant.
Good God, she's my ex, not a hell demon. Just add her.
I half shouted in a loud monotone.
And then there she was.
She was sitting on her bed in our apartment, or rather, my old apartment. I suddenly worried about how she was paying rent. Had I screwed her over? I hadn't even thought about it. Sweat leapt out of my skin. She was leaning on the same big blue pillows, with the same Hundertwasser print hanging up over her bed frame. It was just so. The same. I wondered if she had a new roommate. I wondered how things were going at her job. I wondered if she was bitter that Andy and I had gotten rich and she hadn't. I wondered if she hated me. Then I realized, of course she did, and wondered how much.
Hello? She said,
looking around at all of us with a mix of concern, skepticism, and maybe a bit of resignation. It was the first time we'd talked since I left her apartment. She didn't look angry. She did look annoyed.
Hey,
I replied, unable to think of what else to say. Andy took over for me.
Are you the proletarian?
God damn it, April, she almost whispered. What did you tell them?
That you might be the proletarian, that's all.
If weakening her secret identity was what she was going to be mad at me about, I felt like I was getting off very easy. She looked resigned, not angry, at least not at that moment. And then she had to restart. I got the dream before almost anybody. The first night I had it, I solved 4 sequences. I knew it wasn't just a dream. It's amazing in there. I felt a little guilty that I had spent so little time exploring the dream then. I spent all my time defending it, but also I avoided it.
Are you going to introduce your friends?
Oh God, I'm sorry, Maya, this is Miranda, a materials scientist at UC Berkeley who we've been working with, and Robin, who is my assistant, I said. Andy then cut in.
It's really good to see you, Maya.
It's good to see you too. If you want yet another example of what a shit I am, I hadn't even considered that I basically made Andy choose, and that he had chosen me. Another wave of heat and sweat hit me. Luckily, Andy took over and told Maya the situation with Petrowiki.
Oh yeah, do not give in to that rat-faced shit.
Seriously, if every person got a nickel every time someone else thought something nasty about them, that guy would be the richest man on earth.
Right, no one wants to give in, but we have to do something or he's in control.
First of all, no, he's not. All the more complicated clues require collaboration now anyway. Yesterday there was a passcode uncovered and the key was to have someone who spoke a particular dialect of Hindi and had knowledge of their region's creation myth working with someone who knows abstract mathematics. I was following the whole saga and I still don't really understand. It was something about circles, both geometrical and mythological. It really shows an amazingly detailed understanding of human culture. And for all their strengths, the defenders don't necessarily seem like the most culturally aware group of people. There was a round of agreement. But more important, she continued, we can fuck with them.
Oh, I like the sound of that, I said.
It takes time to check a passcode to ensure that it's real. You can't just pop into the dream, say the passcode, and get the data. You have to go through the whole puzzle sequence, get the password in the dream, and then deliver it. Some of the puzzle sequences take hours.
Oh, this is delicious, I said.
So we just have to set up a racket of people who send Peter Petrowiki fake puzzle sequences and hex codes hundreds of times a day?
No, Maya said. You don't need to do anything. People active in the dreamer community are already working on it.
When I say we can fuck with them, I mean us, not you. No offense, but I don't think you could come up with a convincing fake puzzle sequence to save your life. I did not take offense. I saw myself as a leader of the community, not a member. I had no idea what a messed up perspective that was at the time.
Oh, so we don't have to do anything,
this problem will solve itself. I saw frustration bloom on Maya's face. No, April, this problem will get solved by people who just happen to not be you. Everyone got a little wide-eyed with that rebuke. Miranda blushed bright red while my guess is that my face went a shade whiter. Right, I stammered. Of course. God, I'm sorry, that was a dumb thing to say. Maya just made that face where her lips disappeared in consternation. I hadn't been called on my bullshit in a while. It was unpleasant, but also a little refreshing. If you don't mind me asking, Robin said, how did you get so involved in the Dreamer community? Well, the first night I solved the 49th, 50th, and 51st floor puzzle sequences, the 49th floor, that's the floor you started on, was solved by hundreds of people by the time people realized that it was a shared experience. I had worked out those three, and even a few outside the building when the first Dreamer community started popping up. It made me a bit of a celebrity in those communities. It also didn't hurt that I had the connection to April. She nodded at me. Now I just like it, and the people are amazing, and from all over the world with different ideas and worldviews, all working together toward a common goal. It's a pretty beautiful thing. In fact, you all should spend a little time in the dream. Just look up one of the solved sequences on Wikipedia and go through it. It might give you a better appreciation for the Carls. I know it has for me. Then she sat there for a few moments with a thought on her face before saying, and yeah, I don't know. I probably wanted to stay involved in this stuff in some way. It wasn't as easy for me to leave it behind as I thought it would be. I could tell she was looking right at me. I couldn't find any words to say, and I was worried that if I said them, she would be able to hear the lump in my throat. Speaking of which, I didn't originally want to ask, but there's something you guys could maybe help us out with, if you wanted to. That night, after mulling over Maya's proposal, I decided to take her advice and spend some time in the dream. First, though, I read through some of the more recent puzzle sequences that had been worked out. The one I picked was one of the last ones the Proletarian had credited, though there were two other names I didn't recognize listed beside hers. They didn't uncover it simultaneously, I found. They did it together. When I fell asleep and found myself in the dream's lobby, I turned around and punched the down button on the elevator. The door opened, and I walked in and pushed the button for the lobby. I walked out past the massive, super-sized Carl, out the door and onto the street. The dream streets were not on a grid like Manhattan. They would spur off in diagonals, coming together in three-way or five-way or even six-way intersections. Alleys shut off in surprising locations, and none of the architecture made any sense. I looked back to see the office building where the spawn point was located, so high that, from my vantage point, it looked like it went on up forever, more than 200 stories. It's weird to talk about these things as if they are fact, since they were in a dream. But the fact that everyone experienced it in precisely the same way made it feel concrete. What is reality except for the things that people universally experience the same way? The dream, in that sense, was very, very real. Directly across from the exit of the office building was the Arby's. This magnificent dream location was the best branding Arby's had ever gotten. They'd become the unofficial fast food of dreamers everywhere. Next door to that was the old wooden church, and on the other side of the Arby's was a train car that was definitely not modern. But I couldn't tell you when it was from. Maybe the 1920s? I headed straight across into the Arby's. It was empty, as everything in the dream was. This sequence relied on a fairly detailed knowledge of how the equipment in an Arby's worked. Maya had worked at an Arby's in high school, and was also one of the first people to try this sequence. On the counter next to the cash register was a chicken, bacon, and Swiss sandwich, a large drink, and one of those folded apple pie things. I went behind the counter and punched the corresponding buttons on the cash register to ring up the meal. The cash register tray opened, revealing a bunch of money that I would not have recognized, but knew from reading about it online was from Pakistan. The money to my eyes was useless, but a Pakistani dreamer who Maya had found online determined that a number of letters were missing from the notes. Those missing letters spelled out the Urdu words for floor and under. This remained a mystery for a couple of days until another dreamer had the idea to bring a pry bar from a nearby auto shop and start prying up floor tiles. Just by the cash register where you would stand if you were ordering, they pried up a tile where, underneath, a passkey glowed in bright blue letters.
Double picture day. I didn't need the pry bar. If you knew which tile it was, you could just lift it with your fingernails. I had the passcode now, but I didn't see any reason to go and turn it in. That would just wake me up and give me a hex sequence that everyone had known for weeks. Instead, I started walking around the city. I recognized the styles of about one in every three buildings. There was a craftsman home, a brownstone,